You take a seed, you plant it, you grow it, you dry it, you roll it, you smoke it, and it goes down smooth. Hey!
Spanning the globe to bring you the latest developments in medical cannabis, adult marijuana, industrial hemp, and spiritual ganja.
We love the herb.
It's time for the Marijuana Agenda with Russ Belville. Now, here's your host, Russ Belville.
Good day, tokers and tokettes and non-toking lovers of liberty. It is good to be back. I'll tell you, it's Tuesday, October 17th, 2017, and it's got to be 420 somewhere in the world. And some of you out there are going, where the hell have you been? Well, I'll tell you, folks, I've been out of this Pacific Northwest area to the exact opposite side of the continent in the great southeastern corner of the United States. I was in Atlanta for the past week or so attending the Drug Policy Reform Conference, their biennial conference, 2017. Next conference will be in St. Louis, Missouri in 2019. I'm looking forward to that as well. But what an amazing conference. I'm going to be bringing you some audio highlights of the conference all this week, including a amazing keynote speech that we're going to be bringing to you from Professor Michelle Alexander. She's the author of The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Era of Color Blindness. And it was a rousing opening plenary speech that she gave. We've got the whole half hour speech for you coming up right after the cannabis headline news. And then we'll follow that up with a radical rant, because there's a couple of points that Michelle Alexander makes in her speech that got me to thinking about the future of our movement and whether or not we are losing focus on what we're supposed to be doing here, which I believe is ending the arrests of people who are using marijuana. Or other drugs, for that matter. But we'll talk about mission creep and how the drug reform movement seems to be expanding beyond just the issues of drugs. And we'll discuss whether or not that's a good thing or a bad thing, relating back to some of the things that Michelle Alexander had to say in her discussion. Coming up later in the week, we'll have some other great stuff from the conference as well. A panel on possible marijuana legalization that discusses whether commercialization is a good thing or a bad thing. And there was some great back and forth between two former staffers from Marijuana Policy Project, Steve Fox and Dan Riffle. Yes, Dan Riffle, that's the other name. So plenty of great stuff coming up for the rest of the week. If you miss Drug Reform Conference, I've got the videos on my Facebook page. I'll also upload them to the YouTube page coming up very shortly. But first, let's get caught up on the cannabis headline news.
This is your cannabis headline news, brought to you by MarijuanaMoment.net, the complete source for all your marijuana news in one morning newsletter from Marijuana Majority founder Tom Angel. Subscribe today for free at MarijuanaMoment.net.
This is your cannabis headline news for Tuesday, October 17th, 2017. I'm Russ Belville. Representative Tom Marino was President Trump's pick to be drug czar. His decision to withdraw from consideration on Tuesday is a direct result of a groundbreaking investigation by The Washington Post and CBS's 60 Minutes. Quote, "It's a stunning result," end quote, Jeff Lean, the Post editor in charge of investigations, told CNN Tuesday morning, continuing, quote, "We put the facts out there and we let the other people take care of the results," end quote. The Post story, titled "Drug Industry's Triumph Over the DEA," came out Sunday morning. The two-part 60 Minutes segment aired Sunday night. Trump was questioned about it on Monday afternoon, and Trump announced Marino's withdrawal on Tuesday morning. The newspaper and the CBS News magazine documented how Marino helped drug distributors pass an industry-friendly law that hobbled the Drug Enforcement Agency's effort to halt the spread of the opioid crisis. Marino took nearly $100,000 from the pharmaceutical lobby while advocating for the law, they reported. A report in MarijuanaMoment.net explains how Atlanta Mayor Kasim Reed signed into law a measure that advocates describe as decriminalization and which replaces time behind bars for marijuana possession with modest fines. It had previously passed the city council by a vote of 15 to nothing. Now, a member of Savannah's city council wants the state's fifth largest city to join the capital in significantly lowering cannabis penalties. Alderman Van Johnson announced on Monday that he intends to push his colleagues to pass a measure eliminating the threat of incarceration for possessing up to 1 ounce of marijuana and reduce the punishment from the current $1,000 fine to just $150. And he intends to do it within the next 45 days, the Savannah Morning News reported. But even if the Savannah City Council adopts Johnson's proposal and it is signed by the mayor, Georgia state laws criminalizing cannabis will remain in effect and enforceable in the city, as is the case in Atlanta. The National Football League, still in political crosshairs over whether players should take a knee during the national anthem, is throwing its weight behind another cause in Washington's debate over racial equality: criminal justice reform. The NFL spokesman said on Monday that the league has decided to endorse a bipartisan bill to reduce mandatory minimum sentences for low-level drug offenders, eliminate three strikes provisions that require life sentences, and give judges more latitude to reduce sentences for certain low-level crimes. The owners appear to be seeking middle ground between the football players and their critics during a heated national debate over the growing phenomenon of players kneeling during the national anthem to protest police brutality and racial inequality. Melissa Etheridge says she feels like, quote, a rock star now, end quote, now that she's been arrested for marijuana possession, adding, quote, I'm in good company, the singer tells Variety, referring to others like Paul McCartney, Snoop Dogg, and Willie Nelson, who've been busted for pot over the years. Etheridge was sleeping on her tour bus when it was pulled over by Customs and Border Protection agents in the middle of the night on August 17th in Portal, North Dakota. She'd performed at River Cree Resort and Casino in Enoch, Alberta on August 16th. Last November, North Dakota became the 30th state to legalize the use of medical marijuana, but the state program has yet to start. In California, where she lives, Etheridge has a cannabis card given to patients with a variety of conditions. Etheridge has been treating herself with cannabis ever since she was diagnosed with breast cancer in 2004. Administrators at Evanston Township, Illinois High School confiscated an issue of the student newspaper last month, saying it glorified drug use, drug dealing, and promoted illegal conduct. At a meeting of the District 202 school board last week, the student journalists and First Amendment legal advocates argued that the school may have violated state law by failing to show justification before confiscating the paper, which included a two-page spread focusing on marijuana use and policy. Michael Colton, executive editor, said the Illinois Speech Rights of Student Journalists Act clearly lays out the only justifications for school administrators to seize student newspapers. He said the articles in question did not incite students to commit an unlawful act, did not violate school district policies, and did not substantially disrupt the orderly operation of the school. This has been your Cannabis Headline News for Tuesday, October 17th, 2017. I'm Russ Belville.
You're listening to the Marijuana Agenda with Russ Belville.
Hi, I'm Russ Belville from the Marijuana Agenda. If you appreciate my full-time dedication to reporting and analyzing the news about cannabis, consider becoming a patron of the show. For just $4.20 per month, you'll help keep my live stream and podcast free while earning yourself your own private ad-free podcast link for the show, as well as links to the supporting articles and data. For a $9.99 VIP subscription, you'll get all that plus my exclusive research, data tables, and graphics. Just log on to mjagenda.com and click the Become a Patron button today.
The Marijuana Agenda, Kevin Sabet's boogeyman since 2012.
You have offended my family, and you have offended Shaolin Temple.
Yes, might have gotten away with it too, if it wasn't for these blasted kids and their dogs.
At Herbie's Cannabis Seeds, we pride ourselves on bringing you the best quality seeds from the world's most respected cannabis seed producers, all at the lowest online prices. You can find Herbie's Seeds at herbiesheadshop.com. All cannabis seeds are sold as souvenirs and as a means of preserving cannabis genetics. Herbie's Seeds in no way intends to condone, promote, or incite the use of illegal or controlled substances. We strongly urge all prospective customers to check their national laws prior to placing an order. Herbie's Seeds at herbiesheadshop.com. Proud sponsors of the Marijuana Agenda with Russ Belville.
This is the Cannabis Minority Report. The war on drugs has been called the new Jim Crow for how it disproportionately polices and incarcerates people of color. As marijuana legalization proceeds, institutional barriers still prevent minorities from fully participating in the new industry. Today, we take a deeper look at these issues in the Cannabis Minority Report.
Welcome to the Cannabis Minority Report. I'm Russ Belville. On today's edition of the podcast, we hear from Professor Michelle Alexander, author of The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Era of Colorblindness. This is her keynote speech that she delivered at the Drug Policy Alliance Reform Conference 2017 in Atlanta, Georgia.
Thank you. So many faces that I recognize, so many people that I deeply admire, people who have inspired me, whose work has guided me and challenged me in countless ways. Dorothy Nunn, Susan Burton, Jason Hernandez, those who go on and on. People who have made such a remarkable difference in my own life. Well, I've been giving some thought to what I might say here today, how I spend my short time that I have with you, and I could spend all of it just singing the praises of the people in this room and celebrating the extraordinary accomplishments, the victories that have been won in recent years and as recently as yesterday. But I want to be more than just a cheerleader right now. I want to speak candidly as someone who, like many of you, considers myself part of this movement, but also as someone who is concerned for its future. Standing here, I'm filled with such an odd mixture of overwhelming gratitude and some trepidation. In so many ways, this is the best and worst of times for drug policy. You know, on one hand, as Maria pointed out, there have just been, you know, a tidal wave of extraordinary successes, mind-blowing victories for marijuana decriminalization and legalization, thanks in no small part to the brilliant and strategic advocacy of the people in this very room. Public support for marijuana decriminalization and legalization has never been higher, at record highs. And last November, marijuana legalization initiatives prevailed in 4 states. Medical marijuana prevailed in another 4 states. It seems as though we have reached a tipping point. And yet, at the same time, in the same very moment, we face an unprecedented drug crisis in this country. Drug overdoses are at a record high, making the crack epidemic seem somewhat mild by comparison. A recent report by the Police Executive Research Forum revealed that drug overdose deaths totaled more than 64,000 last year, a 21% increase over 2015. About 3/4 of all those deaths involved opioids. America has 4% of the world's population and 27% of the world's overdose deaths. And many experts predict that we haven't seen the worst of it yet. Already, drug overdose deaths are more numerous than HIV deaths were in 1995, the worst year ever of the AIDS epidemic. Drug overdose last year alone outnumbered American fatalities during the entire course of the Vietnam War. And yes, there is outcry over the opioid crisis, but it's relatively muted considering the magnitude of the crisis at hand. And I know that I am not alone in being struck by the drastic difference between the two recent drug epidemics that have swept this nation, opioids and crack. Now, the crack epidemic killed just a tiny fraction of those who are dying of opioid overdoses today. And yet a literal war was declared on poor people of color, a purely punitive, militaristic media coverage demonizing and shaming opioid users and dealers. There's no live TV coverage of drug addicts and dealers rounded up in mass raids or paraded into courtrooms. There are few politicians blasting the mostly white opioid addicts, portraying them as people worthy of care and compassion, not despicable scum of the earth that has to be gotten rid of by any means necessary. Things are very, very different this time around, and we all know why. Whiteness makes a difference. If the overwhelming majority of the users and dealers of opioids today were black rather than white, we wouldn't have police chiefs competing with each other over whose department is showing more compassion to people struggling with drug addiction and drug abuse. And I want to be clear that I am very glad that the Police Executive Research Forum is actually bragging in its recent report that many police departments are sending officers to the home of addicts to pay them kind visits and invite them to treatment and offer support. But I'm not as optimistic as some of my friends about the future of drug policy in this country. I'm told that this newfound tolerance and compassion for white users and abusers of illegal drugs will translate into a permanent ceasefire in the drug war, and that the shifts in law and policy will inevitably benefit people of all races and classes in the long run. I have my doubts about this. Now, clearly the victories for marijuana decriminalization and legalization have benefited people of all colors, as arrest rates have declined dramatically in many states, even though severe racial disparities do remain. Discriminatory enforcement hasn't changed much, but at least the total number of people arrested and criminalized has declined, a positive development for all people of all colors. Now, my concern lies elsewhere. I'm concerned about the cyclical nature of reform and retrenchment in this country, particularly with respect to race. The great legislative victories to legalize marijuana in several states did not occur in a vacuum. They occurred on the very same night that Donald Trump was elected president of the United States, an election that was made possible in no small part by deliberate, explicit appeals to white racial resentment and anxiety. Now, some have said this is a very, very strange paradox. Progressive drug policy sweeping the nation at the very same moment that Donald Trump is elected president of the United States and a fierce drug warrior is appointed attorney general. How do we explain this crazy state of affairs? Yet from where I sit, there is no paradox, no mystery at all. There's a common denominator underlying both the drug reform victories and the election of Donald Trump. It's called whiteness. Come on! And then predictably, you can set your watch to it. When the color of drug users and dealers fades to white, our nation suddenly reverses course, often quite abruptly. Attitudes change, policies change, compassion bubbles to the surface of the public discourse. Numerous historians have documented this unmistakable pattern. And by the same token, throughout our nation's history, there has always been fierce, overwhelming backlash against even the appearance of great racial progress. Always. You can set your watch to that one too. And while some might argue that the racial justice gains offered by Obama's election were mostly symbolic, the symbolism was powerful and deeply disturbing to millions, helping to incite an electoral backlash that we should have seen coming. Now, of course, I don't mean to suggest that the presidential election and the drug policy victories last year were solely about race, but at the same time, can we honestly imagine that the drug reform victories last year in all those states would have been possible in the midst of the crack epidemic? Just for a moment, try to imagine our nation legalizing any drug of any kind in the middle of any drug epidemic that was affecting primarily Black or brown people. Imagine pot being legalized near the peak of the crack epidemic. And then try to imagine that all the new legal drug empires that are being launched are being led by young Black men with wild afros and tattoos rather than hipster white men with cute ponytails and beards.
Whole or
or in part, is truly not a victory for us all.
Beneficiaries.
Yeah. That's right. research shows that white people are more generous and forgiving with each other than those who are perceived as others. Cognitive science teaches us they can't help it most of the time. We are all primed to value and prefer those who seem like us, though the preferences whites have for themselves are remarkably greater, no doubt due to centuries of brainwashing that have led them to actually believe, often unconsciously, that they are, in fact, superior. Now, Mark Maurer, in his excellent book, Race to Incarcerate, cites data showing that the most punitive nations in the world are the most diverse. The nations with the most compassionate or the most lenient criminal justice policies are the most homogeneous. You know, we like to say that diversity is our strength, but it may actually be our Achilles heel. Researchers have reached similar conclusions in the public welfare context. The democracies that have the most generous social welfare programs, universal health care, cheap or free college education, generous maternity leave, on and on, are generally the most homogeneous. Socialist countries like Sweden and Norway are overwhelmingly white. But when those nations feel threatened by immigration, by so-called foreigners, public support for generous social welfare begins to erode, often quite sharply. It seems that it's an aspect of human nature to be tempted to be more punitive and less generous to those we view as others. And so in a nation like the United States, where we are just a few generations away from slavery and Jim Crow, where inequality is skyrocketing due to global capitalism, and where demographic changes due to immigration are creating a nation in which no racial group is the majority, a central question we must face in this movement is whether we, the people, are capable of overcoming our basic instinct to respond more harshly, more punitively, with less care and concern for people we view as different. Can we evolve? Can we evolve morally and spiritually? Can we learn to care for each other across lines of race, class, gender, and sexuality, and all the questions oppressing in the age of Trump? But they're also the very questions that we must be asking no matter who is president. On the homepage of the Drug Policy Alliance website, the mission statement says, the first sentence says, "We believe drug policies should be based on science, compassion, health, and human rights, not fear and stigma." Now, I read that mission statement is challenging us as a nation to alleviate each other's suffering rather than multiplying it, to respond with reason and compassion rather than fear and stigma, and to honor basic human rights. It's a mission statement that points to something bigger, much bigger than just drug policy reform. Now let me cut to the chase because I know my time is running short. The fate of our democracy depends in no small part on what happens in spaces like this. Whether and how we learn to build movements that reimagine ways of seeing and relating to one another will determine the future not only of drug policy, but the future of our democracy. And in so many ways, the fate of the global community hangs in the balance. Now, the good news is that drug policy presents incredible opportunities for reimagining what our democracy and global community can and should be. We have the opportunity in this movement to educate people of all colors about how our ugly racial history harms us all. White folks today would have a much better public health infrastructure and more treatment options available to them if it wasn't for the birth of a racist drug war. Many white folks are suffering and dying today because of a drug war declared with black folks in mind. Thousands of immigrants are being locked up, warehoused in private detention centers that would not even exist today but for the anti-black racism of the drug war, which gave birth to the private prison. Politics similar fashion. This time leading to a system of mass deportation on a scale rarely seen in human history. We can do that through this movement. And few issues, few causes, few movements provide a better opportunity to practice reparations. Because we have a lot to learn as a nation, we don't have a lot of practice at repairing historical harm that has been caused to poor people and people of color. But we can get started in a real way in this movement right here and right now. And I think it's fair to say that this movement, as much as any other, provides an extraordinary opportunity for us to practice with one another and with the communities we serve. What it means to show care and compassion across lines of race, class, and difference. People of all races and backgrounds are losing loved ones to this drug war. Some to fatal overdoses, others to addiction, and millions more to prison and jail cells. Finally, this movement gives us a chance to talk about capitalism in a way that's addiction as well as incarceration. By interrogating capitalism in the context of drug policy reform, we can also ask important questions such as, what really does a fair market look like when some groups have been systematically denied access to markets and capital? become a movement that is fundamental to the remaking of our democracy. I hope and pray that one day when the history of this movement is written, that it will be said that we, those of us in this room today, vow to do more than win kinder, fairer, more compassionate drug policies. Instead, we committed ourselves to a revolution, to placing racial justice at the center of our work, to reimagining our democracy and our economy, and birthing, with all the courage and strength we can muster, a new America. Let the new nation.
This episode was produced as part of the Marijuana Agenda with Russ Belville, the daily news and interview podcast covering the world of medical cannabis, adult marijuana, industrial hemp, and spiritual ganja. MJAgenda.com.
New beginner guitars and banjos are often constructed much better than ones built before your time. Why struggle? Get a new instrument or fix the old one. The trusted professionals at the Fingerboard Extension will evaluate your instrument for free. Repairs are priced for people who work for a living. Stop by the Fingerboard Extension downtown Corvallis at 120 Northwest 2nd Street today or check out its inventory on the web at fingerboardextension.com.
The Marijuana Agenda. Like the pharmaceutical agenda, without all the side effects, overdose, deaths, you know, insurance.
Side effects may include nausea, dry mouth, and constipation. Dry mouth, constipation, indigestion, and abdominal pain.
Which can occur without warning and may cause death.
Hey everybody, it's Russ Belville from the Marijuana Agenda, inviting you to be like me and get your ink done at Lucky Horseshoe Tattoo, Fort Worth's most female-friendly, clean, sterile, awesome tattoo shop. Thomas and his crew are true artists who can design you a custom piece or use a design you bring in. Lucky Horseshoe also offers all styles of tattooing as well as piercings and all-around fun. In the DFW area, stop by Lucky Horseshoe Tattoo and tell them Radical Russ sent you. Trust me, it'll feel awesome.
Total war against public enemy number one.
10 federal criminal penalties for up to 1 ounce of marijuana.
Marijuana is probably the most dangerous drug.
Just say no. Legalization is just another word for surrender.
I experimented with marijuana and didn't inhale.
This is not medicine. This is a Cheech and Chong show.
Encourage people to use less drugs.
I am ill. That was the point.
I think it would be a mistake to legalize.
Negative reports coming out of Colorado.
Don't smoke marijuana.
As you know, I attended the Drug Policy Alliance's Reform Conference in Atlanta, Georgia, this last week, and we played on the show Professor Michelle Alexander's opening keynote speech, which was a remarkable speech, amazing, of course, one of the greatest thinkers in drug policy and just general social reform that we have in this country. So it's tough for me to have to come out and offer maybe some, I don't want to say contrary points of view, but some points that I think need to be addressed as we think about moving forward as a drug law reform movement more generally and as the marijuana law reform movement more specifically. So it has to do with the overriding theme of Professor Alexander's speech, which I'll get to in a moment, but I want to go back to my Twitter feed because oftentimes I use my @RadicalRuss account as just my stream of consciousness, what's going on around me, and it oftentimes ends up a great way for me to take notes in the middle of a speech where I don't have a pen and a paper or whatever and just get it out there. And so I have some notes from 3 days ago from my account. This was on the 14th, about 7 o'clock, and I'm listening to speakers at the end of the conference, the ending plenary. I don't know if it's the ending plenary or the closing plenary. Anyway, and there was a couple of things that just set off alarms that were said in my head. And I'll apologize in advance if I missed a speaker who added more context to what was said that I'm missing, but there was someone who had mentioned something about how great it will be when we get to the point where we're no longer distinguishing between violent and nonviolent drug crime. Now, maybe the context was we're not distinguishing between people who are involved in possession versus dealing, right? That maybe that someone that's carrying a gun versus someone not carrying a gun. But I'm sorry, I distinguish between violent crime and nonviolent crime. And I know a whole lot of voters, especially in the middle of the country, who, if they heard that part of the goal, part of the agenda of the drug reform movement was to end a distinction between violent and nonviolent crime, to not hold people accountable who commit violence to a greater degree than we hold people accountable for nonviolent acts. This has nothing. I mean, maybe there's a context I'm missing because it just seems so outrageous when I heard it. I remember the last time I was in Atlanta, I was at the Not One Step Back movement event, Drug Policy Alliance, when there was another thing that was said that just caught me, you know, shocked me, which was to imagine a police-free world, to have a world without police. And maybe I missed some context again. Maybe, you know, less police at the community level. There should only be for certain things. Maybe I missed something earlier, but you try to take that where I to the districts where I grew up in and say, yeah, we're advocating for a world where there's no police. You'll be laughed off the doorstep. You'll never win a vote. There was another thing that was in my Twitter feed, which was, and I believe there was one of the gentlemen from South America, I think, but he had said something about, you know, fighting for this, for the end to capitalism, this end of capitalism. Sorry, what? That's going to cause some problems in the voting booths if that's what we're perceived to be doing here. So my larger question in this rant is, are we the drug law reform movement or are we the fix everything wrong with society movement? How broadly are we going to take this? Now, I'm asking. I'm, you know, I am for all of these things in a general sense. I think there are excesses to capitalism that certainly need to be reined in. Globalism and inequality, absolutely should be reined in. But I also think there's a lot of good things about capitalism. I mean, capitalism created the internet and the mic and the computer that I'm working on, right? So I got to like it at some level. Now, the excesses of capitalism that led to the child labor putting together the phone that I have or whatever other atrocity we could talk about, yes, needs to be addressed. So I don't have the answers. I'm asking a lot of the questions here is what I'm saying. And I agree that we are over-carceral, right? We go to criminal justice solutions too quickly and far too much force. Absolutely. Our police kill far more people than any other countries that are like us. You know, countries like us, we're an outlier. There's something wrong with us. So are we the fix everything wrong with society movement or are we the drug law reform movement? Because in Michelle Alexander's speech, she said a couple of things that to me had some dissonance, kind of threw me off a little bit. So let me just get to them. She got a great deal of applause for a statement that had the gist of it was that we need to put racial justice and social justice in the center of drug policy, have it at the center of our drug policy reform efforts. Okay, I think that's a laudable thing, absolutely. But she also said, could you imagine us legalizing marijuana back in the day when there was the crack epidemic going on? And that drug laws change and there's more compassion when the face of those drug laws is white. And that when we try to use just racial statistics, you know, disparity statistics, that just enforces and confirms the stereotypes that people have. And sometimes she even said that, you know, diversity could be our Achilles heel. Well, if it is, why would we make our Achilles heel the center of how we're trying to change the laws? She even, Michelle Alexander even said early in the speech that she didn't think we needed to end racism to win the drug war. Okay, I agree. We don't have to end racism to end the drug war because that's, you know, that's a tall bar to clear. You know, we're talking about centuries and centuries and millions of people. Which, again, broaches the question, are we the fix everything wrong with society movement, or are we the drug law reform movement? And to what extent does trying to fix everything detract from the drug law movement? She made a joke about, would we see legalization if the people that were getting the industry were, you know, young black men with dreadlocks rather than white hipsters with beards and ponytails? Well, if the answer to that is no, and then the answer to preventing the feds from cracking down on us is to have a big, vibrant industry, then wouldn't it be a mistake to try to feature the black side of that industry if it being white is what's keeping it legal? Is there a point where we should maybe say it needs to be white long enough to be big enough to then bring in and start bringing and becoming a more inclusive, diverse movement? And part of what brings me to this is as an aside, I attended the Atlanta Pride Festival, right? And I was talking to another activist there who had shown up, Lanny Swerdlow, who's just a fantastic guy. He's with the Brownie Mary Democrats. I'd seen him also at the Drug Law Reform Conference, right? And he had asked, you know, about why, you know, why are we trying to court any Republicans on this issue when if we just tip the House and the Senate to Democrats, we could pass all these, you know, bills, CARES Act and other things and do more for the people. Why are we trying to play both sides? Why don't we pick a side and go with it? Which again speaks to my broader question. Are we the fix everything movement or are we the get shit done movement? The shit that we need done, which is drug law reform. And you know, if it being white, if the marijuana thing being white is what allowed it to become legal and the people in the businesses, I'm not saying keep it that way necessarily. I'm just saying if that's what made it happen, then maybe we should take advantage of that, because it being white doesn't change the law for everyone. I mean, Michelle Alexander did cite how the remaining marijuana arrest statistics and law enforcement statistics are still racially disproportionate, which goes back to, we're not going to solve racism in one fell swoop, of course. But she also noted and acknowledged that far fewer arrests of everyone has brought, you know, including black people, Latino people, has brought down, that is a good thing. So if we are within a racist system, then maybe we leverage its racism by trying to make the drug war as white as possible. Maybe we make our messaging about how many white people are affected. Maybe we take advantage, like Donald Trump did, take advantage of a big middle of America that thinks this way, and use that to our advantage. Start, instead of coming out with the beautiful flyer or poster or booklet that shows people of all ethnicities and sexual orientations on the thing, and putting that out in Enid, Oklahoma to try to change some minds, maybe you recognize the audience you're dealing with and that you're not going to solve their racism and homophobia. But maybe if I show them a flyer full of white people who are affected by the drug war, we can at least end the drug war, which by doing that will help all the people that we're trying to help. You know, I had kind of asked, you know, I had gotten to this tangent about the Atlanta Pride Parade. And one of the things that Lanny had said was about, you know, how you saw Pepsi and Delta Airlines and Humana Healthcare. I don't know if Humana was there. I'm picking names out of a hat. But there were, you know, big UPS, right? Big corporations that are all a part of that Pride Festival thing. He's like, you don't see that for our movement, do you? You don't see any corporations coming out for our movement, do you? And so why is that? Well, I think a big degree of why the gay movement has so much corporate friendliness now is they became visible within the corporations themselves, and most especially with on the bottom line of how much money that they contribute to their particular economies and so forth, businesses. Once they became an economic might, they got more visibility. So once again, if our marijuana movement is gaining economic might through the way it is right now,
does it make sense for us to, at this time, and again, maybe this is just a timing thing, but at this time, does it make sense to put racial justice at the center when trying to take that message to the middle of the country or the South might not work? Again, asking questions. She did, because I agree with Michelle Alexander's point that when the opiate epidemic back in the 60s was associated with black people, heroin was bad and we had the terrible, you know, media portrayals. When the victims of the crack epidemic were black, we had the 24-hour, you know, this is crack, it's terrible, look at how these neighborhoods are destroyed, these people are committing crimes. You know, I grew up during that era. I grew up during the crack epidemic era and all the scaremongering about that. And it is different now that the opiate epidemic is primarily white faces in rural America, even, that are having to deal with that. So I don't have the answers, I guess, is what I'm saying. I have a lot of questions, and I'd love the chance to talk about this with more people. But at this point, we're kind of out of time. Almost done a whole hour today. It's almost like the good old days here. The Marijuana Agenda. Thanks for joining us. We'll have more from the conference tomorrow. We're going to open up a whole nother can of worms. It's my job to tap dance through the landmines here, tap dance through the minefields of drug policy reform. We're going to talk about, are marijuana businesses the right way to go? Should we do more like social clubs, cannabis clubs, like they do in Spain? See you tomorrow, folks.
Follow MJ Agenda on Facebook, Pinterest, Instagram, YouTube, and follow MJ Agenda Show on Twitter. Learn more at MJAgenda.com.
For everyone here at Delta 9 House of Studios, I'm Radical Russ. Thanks for joining us, and until next time, take care of each other, tokers.
You take a seed, you plant it, you grow it, you try it, you roll it, you smoke it, and it goes down smooth.